Yeah, so queues are a little different because they don't provide me with a storage space per se. It's basically a way for me to buffer the delivery of my storage. So the idea here is that, let's say I want to send data to another system. But typically, if I don't use some type of a queue mechanism, I have to send that data and kind of wait for that other system to come back and say, okay, I got it, right? Here, I can basically put the data in a bucket and not worry about the other system picking it up. Because I know that I can at least, I have a guarantee that that data is going to be read at least once. So once I put it in the bucket, I can kind of forget about it. So my system doesn't have to be tied up waiting for that response. It could go ahead and start doing other things. So that's why queues are pretty nice, because it allows me to improve the performance of my system. Drives are also a pretty interesting idea. The idea here is that, you know, we take some block storage and we build an abstraction on top of that to make it look as a TFS a volume, NTFS a volume. So basically, to the programmer, it looks like a regular hard drive, when in reality, it's a piece of data on a block on the sky. So what that gives me is, if I already have code that is talking, that I have a piece of software that's running on a server somewhere, and that software is talking to a local drive, and then I decide to move that system to the sky, I don't have to change the logic in the way that I'm saving data to, or reading data from that drive. I would just map our drive, in this case, you know, to SQL Azure Storage drive, and be able to do my operations as if nothing has happened, right? So that's the idea there. Is I can use block storage with a drive or NTFS interface. That's actually not available on Azure now. It will be available on Azure 1.1.1, which should be released shortly. So it's not available as of today. So SQL Azure features, you know, some of the things that we do support. We support tables. So I'm going back now to SQL Azure, the relational database engine. We support tables. We support indexes. We support views, script procedures, triggers, constraints, table variables, temp tables, the things that you are expect out of a relational database system we support today. Now, some of the things that we don't support is access to the physical server. So you don't have access to the actual server per se. So you don't have access to the drives in the server. You don't have access to the catalogs. You don't have access to the CLR, meaning that you cannot write SQL procedures using the CLR like you can on SQL Server 2005 and 8. The service broker is not available. Reporting services are not available. Analysis services are not available. And distributed transactions are also not available. Now, we do plan to change some of that availability. So, for instance, we do plan to release the business intelligence capabilities and some other things that will be coming down the road. So this is the first release. Obviously, more features will be added as the platform matures. So how does the whole deployment thing works? It's actually pretty simple and very easy. The way that I interact with my SQL Azure databases is basically using SQL Server Management Studio 2008 R2 release. So I can use the SQL Server Management Studio that I'm already familiar with, the ones that I'm using to talk to my local databases. I can use the same tools to talk to SQL Azure. Okay. Now, I also do have a portal that I can use to communicate and to manage my databases as well. And I'll show you that portal in a second. That portal also happens to have a set of APIs that I can use to communicate with. I won't show you the APIs, but I'll show you what I mean in a second with that. So basically what happens is I have my data script, my database script, and I send my data script just talking to the SQL Azure using the standard TDS protocol, tabular data service, I think it stands for. And that guy is then responsible for provisioning the machines for me, right? So every time I create a new database, notice there that three little dots, three little servers that got initiated. I'll talk more about that in a second. So my application, basically, the only change that I need to make is go to the configuration file, and change the configuration string or the connection string to point to my database in the sky, and I'm done. Right? That's basically the way that I do that. Well, kind of. I'll show you what I mean in a second. So now my application goes from talking to my local server to talking to one of those databases that I that were created for me in the on the cloud. Only one, right? Even though three were created, I only talk to one. So what happens is when you procure one database, we create three replicas of it, with one being the single primary. So at any given time, you're talking to one, but we're creating three replicas of your database. Why? Because for redundancy purposes. So if one server happens to go down, and remember, SQL Azure is running on commodity hardware, right? So stuff fails, right? It's just not if it's going to happen, it's when hardware is going to fail. So because of that, we always replicate onto two other services, so you know that your data is safe. And not only safe, but it's available. So once I do that, basically what happens is the brain of the operations, once a detects failure, detects a server or system being down, it will automatically reroute the traffic to the other replica. And in the meantime, that's happening, that server that went down is replicating itself. Okay? Yeah.
Does this have anything to do, or does this replace clustering and
sort of those? The whole notion of clustering is not available. We do clustering for you. It's available with the idea behind SQL Azure is that we're taking care of the management for you. We're taking care of all the scalability issues that you might have. We're taking care of all that for you out of the box. So we're doing the clustering. We're doing the replicas. So you don't actually have access to the replicas. So even though we're creating two other replicas, you don't have access to those. We just do that to make sure that we can provide a level of reliability and availability to the system.
Is this supposed to replace clustering
levels? No, because you will still have your local SQL environments, if you will. This is just an option that we're giving you. If you want to not have to worry about managing your own environment, then you can just kind of do it here.
Okay. The data is stored in shared
storage? It's stored in our clouds. It's stored in our data centers.
Yeah, but is it one copy or is it three copies?
Three copies.
Okay, so it's three distinct.
Yes, that's my understanding. I could double check that, but that's my understanding.
And you're just recording on the cloud. So.
Exactly. So I'll actually show you this live on this screen here. So I'm going to skip through some of these screen graphs. The reason why we have them here is in case that we lost connection, I was able to show you still. And trust me, they have in one of the tests that we did before.
I was just wondering, what would you do if you wanted to retrieve the database as it existed 6 months ago in some arbitrary period?
We'll talk about backups and things like that in a second. That's a great question. The question was regarding backups and being able to get the data from months ago. We have a simple firewall engine, which basically allows you to provide the ranges of IP that you actually want to connect to your database. So this gives you a level of security. So if you want to limit only to your local services to be able to access that, you can do that here as well. Very, very simple firewall rules here. Connection string is very similar to the connection string that you will use. The only difference is because we don't have we're using SQL accounts here, SQL user. You have to make sure that your string goes from username to user ID because we're not using Windows authentication to connect to the server. We're using SQL authentication. So because of that, the only thing that you might have here that might change in your code is the keyword user ID goes from username if you're using Windows authentication to user ID. Everything else is basically the same. And if you're already using SQL authentication today, then it's the same string, just different values, right, that you have to change. And I'll talk more about that in a second. In fact, let me give you that quick demo now. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to open SQL Management Studio. And again, this is SQL Management Studio 2008 R2. I'm able to install this without having to install the entire database. So I just have the the management product here. So here you will notice that I have, I'm going to connect to the database the same way that you connect to any other database, right? I'm providing a server name. And if you notice the server name here, what's my, my mouse bindings are off here. I can zoom in, but anyway, that's fine. So my connection string here to the server will always have the last part here will obviously be the same. Database that Windows.net it's just our, you know, that's our address. In front of that, you have your actual server name, which is provided to you when you procure one of these servers. So this is an arbitrary number, you know, some encrypted, you know, information here, hard to remember. However, the username I chose, notice it says Danilo Diaz. I'm sure I'm not the only Danilo Diaz in the world. I might be the only one using SQL Azure this time, but still, this is unique to your database. And it has to be followed by the name of the server. Okay, so it's the username add, and then you put your password, you connect, and at first it should fail. And the reason it's going to fail is because I haven't provided this local IP to my firewall rule. So I'm going to do that now, which is why I didn't do it before, so I can show you. So here's the, that's not it. Here is the portal. In this case here, I have the portal for Windows Azure for the, all the stuff, for the storage. For SQL Azure, it's a separate tab. I'm just going to click here on it. I need to sign in. For you, this will be a simple sign in using Live ID. I have to use Microsoft Federated Services here because they don't want me to use my local ID. And I don't want to pay out of pocket, so I'm using the Microsoft account here. So, oops. But you shouldn't see this. This for you would just be a simple Windows Live authentication on screen. So this is going to load up here any minute now. And from here, I'm going to be able to select my database. And I think I have a couple there. So here's my server. I'm not going to drop it, but to create, I literally just said create server. I provided my username. I also provided the location. So basically here I'm saying that I want this to live in our data centers to the north on central USA, which basically means Chicago. We have data centers in Chicago. We have some in Texas. We have some in Asia and Europe. Actually, two in Asia, two in Europe. There might be more. I know we're building these data centers as we speak, so there might be more now than when I first did the research. Here are my database. So I have three databases right now. So I'm going to go to the firewall rules for them, and I'm going to add a rule. So this is the Marvern Office. And here is actually detecting for me the IP address that I might be using. So I'm just going to, oops. Close. So I'm going to kind of copy that, hit submit.
Basically, you open that up to everyone in this office.
To everyone here connecting from this IP address. Mm-hmm. If it happens to be this office, yeah. But I only provided my IP in this case. So if I'm using static IP, it will only be me.
Yeah.
So.
Nobody in static.
Yeah. So let's try that again now. Now, static could take up to a minute. It hasn't taken that long for me. In fact, there you go. The longest I think it's taken is literally a minute. So I am now connected to my database in the sky. You can see here two systems that I have open. So how do I create these items? Well, I can go in, and here's my demo. I can database. I can go in, right click, set create new table, so I can model my tables. Oh, but wait. When I do that, I get a script template, right? So the tooling is not all there yet. So the tooling basically allows me to do the nice UI modeling to my database. However, what I can do is this. I can model a local database, right? And then I can script it out and migrate it over. Not quite, because there are some features not supported in SQL Azure. So what I need to do is, I can use a tool, and the tool I have over here is called the SQL Azure Migration Tool. And basically what this tool does is it has a configuration file with a whole bunch of regular expressions that basically tells the system what keywords are not supported by SQL Azure. So in this case here, I'm going to come in, I'm going to run the tool, and from here, I'm going to say I want to analyze and migrate a T-SQL file. So I can talk to a database. I don't have the local database here. I do have a local script, though. So I'm going to select that file, browse, and I'm going to select this file here that I already created. Basically, it's a local database that I had, which I scripted out. So I'm going to select the file, hit next, and literally, it's going to go ahead and create a script that is SQL Azure friendly. Okay, so that easy, I now have not only my schema, but I also have data with the script as well. Now, from here, I can save it if I want to, or I can click Next. And clicking Next allows me to actually connect to my server on the sky using the APIs that I mentioned earlier. So this application is taking advantage of the APIs available so they can communicate with that database. Now, this just do a simple search for a SQL Azure migration tool, and it's going to give you, it's going to take you to the Coplex site. I'm going to have that on my blog, along with all the different PowerPoints and demos that we use here today. I'll have a blog post sometime by the end of next week available, with also the links to the videos. So what I'm going to do here now is I'm going to go back to the portal, so I can steal a couple things. I want to steal the name of the server. Come back here, do that. Here, this is going to be, I think I say Danilo Diaz, if I'm not mistaken. Oops. Add, just remove everything else. Here, there you go. Oh, geez. Let me see if I remember my password. If not, we can create a new one. I think I have the, let me see. If I forgot, I have to recreate it. Yeah, I think I forgot about it. So, huh? I don't think it's case sensitive, but let's see. I use a very simple password for these things. I guess it's not simple enough. Okay, let me just change it before. So it's actually very easy to change it. I can just come here and reset password. And I'm going to put in the new password. Passwords do not match, okay. Let's see. There we go. Changed. So let's go back here, and I probably have forgotten by the time I get to the screen. There we go. And you're going to see, oops. No, this is, again, this migration tool is an open source project out there, so it's not, you know, if it failed on me, we'll start it all again. Let's exit that and come back here. So we want to analyze it and run it, select the script. Hit next. It's going to go ahead and create that for us. Hit next. Oh, geez, I got to connect to this again. So, Danilo Diaz at and password. Okay, so I should go ahead. Talk to the APIs and bring back the databases that I have already procured. And here you go. I see the two databases that I already have. So here I want to add another one. So I'm going to say create. And here I'm going to call this Firestarter. Oops. So I can go ahead and create it. Now, notice how I have two options, 1 gig or 10 gigs. Right now, those are just the limitations that we have So you can either do a 1 gig database or 10 gig database, and they're priced. Currently, 1 gig is $10 a month. 10 gigs is $100, $99 a month. But you also pay for the bandwidth that you use back and forth, which is like 12 cents or 15 cents, depending if it's in and out. If you need a bigger one, what you can do, you can always do partitioning. So you can, so let's say you need a like a 15 gig database, you can always just create two databases and then just partition half of the data here, half of the data there. But you have to manage that partition yourself. Right? I mean, that's a limitation of the platform right now. But chances are really that, I mean, I'm not saying that there are no databases that are more than 10 gigs, but most of the databases that we work with, no, probably be small enough that, that will fit in that range. Exactly. Exactly. So I'm going to click next here. And what's going to happen now is I am going to execute that script against my server. So there you go. I am actually already creating my database in my cloud server with very little effort. Right? So kind of nice the way, you know, the tooling allows me to do that. So if I go back here, which I probably will have to reconnect. Oh, I'm still connected. There's my database here, FiveStarter. Okay, and here are my tables. So I can come here and say item, and if I want to, oh, where's that guy here? I need curry. I can basically just do this, the things that I'm already familiar with doing. And run it, and it should be able to get the results back, right? So standard SQL stuff that that we're already doing today. It's nothing different here. So let's go back here to our deck. So as far as migration, you saw there how we can basically script the database out, then use this migration tool to do it for us. We can use SIS, SQL Server Integration, SQL Server Integration Services to migrate data from one server to another. Again, we can use this migration script, migration tool. Very, very cool. Makes it very easy for us to do that, to do the migration. And then we can also use SQL Management Studio, right, to talk to our databases to be able to navigate through the data and such. Now, there are limitations. So you asked about backups. Right now, there's no way that you can do a scheduled backup like you're accustomed to doing. That might come down the future. Right now, you will use something like SSIS to just bring data every day, or you know, just keep it yourself. You can do you can use the sync framework to basically sync your database from one server to another. You can write a script to take. To script the database and save it in a blob storage somewhere. So you're responsible right now for doing the backups. Because the backups that we do are not transactional backups, so that I can go back and roll the database back to like 3 months ago or something like that. So that was SQL Azure, right? Relational database in the cloud. It's for the data storage. Yeah. The SQL server size is for the data storage. So we'll now come to SQL data storage, right? This is totally separate from SQL Azure, right? SQL Azure is relational. This has nothing to do with a relational database. The way that I will create an account, again, I'll go through the portal. I'll show you, I might show you that later. But basically, that's a little small. But it's the same way. In fact, let's go back to that portal now. So I'm going to go here from SQL Azure to Windows Azure. And then within Windows Azure, I'm going to go to the storage option. I already have a project set here. So here it is. This project happens to be a storage project. And here I have, I created my endpoints for my blob storage, for my queue storage, for my table storage, and you will see that in a minute. I also have here I'm not going to show you all of it, but I have my primary keys, and I'll show you how that works in a couple of minutes. I can regenerate new keys and things like that. But this is where I will procure that that storage. Azure storage is priced differently. You don't pay by the size; you pay by the transactions. So there's no notion of if I have a file that is 5 megs, it's going to be X. It's basically by the data transfers that goes back and forth. So let's go back here. So here, when you procure an account, you have the notion of an account name and an account key. So the key is basically what allows you to connect and access your data from your system. And we'll talk about that in a second. Now, talked about three different options, right? Blobs, tables, and queues. Blobs, totally unstructured data storage, which you partition by this thing that we call containers. So think of containers as a folder, almost. So you put in files, you put blobs in this container, and you name the container, you name the files individually as well, but there's no structure to them whatsoever. And you can have unlimited containers. The size of each entry, though, of each blob, is limited to 50 gigs. Okay? You can have multiple, but one can only be 50 gigs, which is a lot of data for one file. You can think about, for instance, these files, every time we record this hour session, they're about 120 megs, 180 megs. So you can think how big these, how much data 50 gigs can store. I'm going to skip the three demos next. I'm just going to do them all once so that it just makes more sense to, instead of going back and forth. SQL, Azure Data Storage is a little different from blobs. In this case, we do have some type of a semi-structured data. It's extremely scalable, and we'll talk about it in a second. This is really the big point of using table storage. The way that you partition this is that tables contain, you also have a bucket, some type of a container, where you put these things called entities. Now, tables have entities or rows, and entities have properties or columns. Right, so that's the way that you kind of structure these. Now, the nice thing about the table storage is that if you ever need to, because they don't have a schema, right, there's not a schema I'm providing, for me to change that structure is extremely easy. Right? I don't have to go ahead and change a whole bunch of indexes around, things like that. I can literally just change a property, add a property, you know, and I have, you know, changed my schema. We do support basic transactions over a single entry, and we can access this data using very simple .NET APIs using REST, or we can actually use ADO.NET data services. Right? We can use the same whole idea that Bill talked about, the whole old data idea. We can use that, paradigm to access our data. Okay, so again, tables contains entities contain rows. Now, there are two properties or columns that each entity must have, right? They will all have a partition key, and the partition key basically defines what table belongs to, what family of tables, if you will, it belongs to. And then the other thing is the actual entity ID, which basically defines the actual row, right? So row key, partition key was the, yeah, partition key, row key is the actual one and the entity. We also have a timestamp, which we basically tell, you know, when this file with this entry got added. And you will see that in code in a little bit. Now, some of the differences between SQL Azure tables and Windows Azure tables are some of the differences, right? So SQL Azure are fully structured, strongly tied, relational, highly scalable, right? So I can have a relationship between tables. Azure tables are semi-structured, loosely typed, right? So I can change the schema at any time. Non-relational at all, so I can have relationships between tables and things like that. I can always match them up using link and do, you know, queries on them, but I don't have a physical relationship. But the scalability is massive, right? So I can scale to the nth degree. Now, again, SQL Server is extremely scalable, but this is takes it, you know, to a totally different level. Let's say I need to store server log files, right? They're semi-structured, right? They have some columns and some rows, and if it's a pretty popular site, I mean, it's just a huge file, I'm talking about terabytes. Well, I can very easily parse that data using something like SQL Azure Table, whereas if I try to migrate that to a relational environment, it's going to take me a long time first of all to enter the data into SQL Server, and then to actually chunk through that data is probably not going to be as efficient as me using a flat database system such as SQL Azure Table. Again, I'll skip over this demo. I'll show you that in one combined demo. So queues. Again, they're not an actual physical data store unit. It's more of a way for me to buffer the delivery of my storage. I can guarantee that it's going to at least get read once. I can delete, you know, remove the message from the queue, or I can leave it there for future references if I want to. Typically, you want to process the queue, delete it. Right? I mean, that's typically the pattern that you might use. And the way that we partition this is by a queue name. And you will see that in the code right now. So let's go through some demos. Oops. So I'm going to open up here Studio. 2010, and I'm going to run it as an administrator. Now, the nice thing about, Azure, is that I don't always have to be in the cloud for me to develop against it. So I actually have an environment, a local environment that mimics the cloud 100%. So all the APIs that I have in the cloud, I also have them here locally through this thing called the Developer Fabric. So the Developer Fabric, again, is a it's part of the SDK. And I'm just going to, I have them here on my taskbar. I'm just going to get it started, both the developer storage and SQL Azure itself. Because I can always, I can mimic not only SQL Azure, I mean, I always get confused with these names. I can mimic Azure's environment using the DevFabric, and I can also mimic Azure's data storage environment using the developer storage environment. So I run both of these. They're both part of the SDK. Okay. So that should be running, and here you go. They're both started. I can see my notification there. If I want to see or get more information on my environment, my developer environment, I can go here and click on Show UI for the Fabric. I can also show the UI for the developer storage. And it's nice sometimes to have access to these because if I'm saving a lot of data to my local storage, I can then delete it very easily, reset the environment without having to run any type of script. So I can very easily write testable scripts that would just erase the local storage every single time I run a test on my data. So you can see here the developer fabric. There's nothing running because I haven't run anything yet. And here's my developer storage, right? It gives me the endpoints. So the same way that I have my endpoints here for my actual live storage, right? I can see what those endpoints are for my local storage here. They're local. And the way that we mimic this is behind the scenes. We're saving the data into a SQL Express database, basically. But you don't communicate with the SQL Express, and then you communicate through the APIs. All right, so I'm going to minimize this and close this guy as well. Let's go to, where is Studio? Oh, here you go. Okay. So I'm going to go ahead and open up this guestbook application that I have. This is provided by the SQL Azure Training Kit. Again, just do a search, do a Bing search on it. You will find it right away. I will also have this on my blog as links so that you can have a quick access to it. All right, so I'm going to run the application first, and then we'll step through the code so I can show you what the application, I'll show you what the application does first, and then we'll see what the code is the code that we have to accomplish that. While that loads up, I'll share some information on the actual project. So here we have four different projects. The first one, obviously I'm going to lose that. Here you go. The first one is this thing called Guestbook. This is the actual Azure project type. There's no code involved here, only configuration files. So I have these notions of roles. Now, roles in Azure are basically, think of these as processor types. Web roles are virtual instances, VPCs, that can be accessed from the outside. So web roles are typically ASP.NET projects or WCF projects. Worker roles are also virtual environments, virtual VPCs, but you don't have access to them from the outside, meaning that nobody can call from the outside, outside of the data center, can actually be called, you know, a set of APIs from the worker role. The worker roles are internal, typically are used by the web roles to have the worker roles do some processing for them. Make sense? So think of the worker role as my front-end data server, web server, and the worker roles as my back-end workers, you know, doing stuff for me. So here's my application. It's really simple. It's a Guestbook app. Guestbook were very popular in 1994. Guestbooks are basically like the pre-Twitter, right? It's like a version of Twitter before Twitter even existed. So I'm going to put my name, and I'm going to say, hello there, loving that Blink tag. And Blink was a tag used back in 1994. So I'm going to browse, select the picture. Nope, there's nothing there actually. Come here, penguins, click submit, and two things are going to happen. Once I get this huge picture, and then that picture is going to get minimized in a couple seconds. Now, you guys know what happens when I click this browse button here? Obviously, you know in the back end when I select this, you know, when I enter information, there you go. When I enter information into the name text box, on the server, I get a string, right? Same thing with the message. It's a text box. On this file picker, if you will, I don't get a string. I actually get a file string. So I get the actual file as a string that I can then read from the code behind. Right? That's actually what gets returned from this control. So keep that in mind. All right, so that's the whole thing there. So let's go to the code and see what happens. So as I was saying, my Azure project here defines two roles. One of them is a worker role and the other one's a web role, which basically is telling the system I want entry point to my server, to my website, and I also want some type of a processing power that I can use behind the scenes. Now I can use the web role to do a lot of things that I'm doing here, but I will tie it up. The idea here is I want the web role to keep taking in requests and then send that request to the worker role so I can do some asynchronous synchronous programming. So this is what's happening behind the scenes. This is, let's go back and talk about the other projects. I have a Guestbook data. It's nothing more than my data access layer, if you will. And we'll spend some time on that project in a second. Then I here have a C# web role, which is an ASP.NET project. And I have a VB worker role. So you can see you can mismatch languages if you want to. Okay? So I'm going to go to default.asp.net, which is the entry point, obviously. But I'm actually interested in the code behind here. Okay? So what's happening is the first thing that I do when I actually click submit, I go ahead and initialize the storage environment. So if we take a look here, I'm doing nothing more than basically creating a pointer to my storage account. So here I say storage account, file storage account, get it from the configuration. So I'm basically reading my configuration file, which is over here in this project, in the Guestbook project, and I'm grabbing all my my connection string, basically. When I'm ready to move this to production, I change the string there, the configuration file, and now I'm in production. Right? Nothing fancy there. Once I have this blob storage account, right, I can go ahead and create a blob client. Once I have the blob client, I can create a container. In this case, I'm going to call it Guestbook Pictures. Okay? And then if that container doesn't exist, I want to make sure that I create it if it doesn't. Right? So this is a nice cool of nice API here, a nice method that can basically initialize my container just in case I don't have it already. So instead of me having to do if container doesn't exist, go ahead and create it, blah blah blah. It's done by one API. Then I come here and I set the permissions for that container. Now, in this case, I'm setting it as public access, which basically means this. With public access, it means that the user does not need a key to read the data, but you always need the key to write to the queue or to the block. Okay? So that's what it means by public access. And there's a few choices here. I have to stop it here. Okay. I can set it to public. I can set it to share access. You know, so there's a few options that I have available. So that's that. Now, so that I don't have to tell you about queues later on, so we'll have to come back to this particular method here. I'm basically doing the same thing with queues. I create a pointer to my queue client. I point it to the container. If the queue container doesn't exist, create it, right? The bucket, the folder. All right, so that's that. Let's go back here to our click method. All right, so making this a little bit bigger there. So now that I have my that the storage is initialized, I'm going to make a reference to that container, and then I'm going to take a string and I'm going to give it a name. I'm going to give it a file name. In this case, it's going to be image underscore some GUID here and JPEG at the end, right? So I'm creating a file name for my system. I need to make sure that this is unique. That's why I'm using GUID, right? I don't just want to name it Penguins because somebody else can come later on and name it Penguin too. That wouldn't make any sense. So that's why I'm using a GUID. I'm going to provide the content type of this blob. In this case, it's going to be an image because that's what I'm selecting. But the content type could be a video. It could be a text file. It could be many things, right? So I'm grabbing the content type from the actual file stream that got provided by that browse file control. Then I'm simply going to say blob upload to the blob from a stream. So I'm simply just going to pass the stream. Extremely easy API. I was expecting to have to convert the string, to have to do a whole bunch of stuff. In this case, boom, just pass the string, and I'm done, right? Then I'm just going to come here, and I'm going to write to the trace, and you'll see that in a second, what I mean by that. So now I have this big file in my blob somewhere, right, in my storage. In this case, it's local storage, but it could be also be in the cloud if I selected cloud earlier, if I selected the actual cloud for my configuration. So we have our file. Second thing that I need to do is I need to create a table entry because I want to keep also the message name, the name of the guest, and the message that he provided, right? And there's some of the things I want to keep too. So the first thing I'm going to do here is I'm going to create this thing called guest entry, which is basically a class that I created. Now, if we go to the definition, we see that this is a very simple class that happens to inherit from table service entity. Right, which is part of the APIs. It's part of Microsoft of this namespace here, Microsoft Windows Azure Storage Client, which again comes from the API. So this guy here, this class provides me with some of the properties that every single table must have. Right, we talked about having a partition, a row key. Those things are every single table must have that. Every single entity must have that. So that's what I'm providing here. In fact, if we go and we navigate to that, you can see that I have a property called partition, row, a key, and timestamp, right? The things that I talked about earlier. So that's basically all this guy is doing, nothing more. So this here is the message, the way that I want to define my message. Now, we talked about this, you know, having a schema. Think of this as my schema, right? It's the way that I'm defining that message structure. And I can always add stuff to it if I want to without having to cause a lot of problems. So that's that. Let's close it. Now, I also have this thing called a guestbook data entry data source. So to evaluate that a little further, we're going to go back here to this data project, which is a simple class library. It's nothing fancy here. This is also where we had defined our guestbook entry. So here I have two other files. I have this data context. And the data context, again, is going to inherit from this thing called table service context. And this is basically what's going to give me the ability to create link queries against my data source, my table data. So if I'm not sure if Bill actually showed you that you can programmatically call all data information using link. This is basically the same thing because this information is provided via a RESTful API, which is what all data is. So here is just a simple file that I needed to access that that information. This is my context. If you're using Link2SQL, notice that Andy had to create a context so that he can talk to his SQL database. Right? That's how we. That's the first thing he did. I'm unsure. He created a context class so that he can communicate with the SQL server. Dane did that as well, creating the context class for the entities. Right? This is the same thing. I'm creating a context class for my table stores. In this case, the tools are not there yet, so I couldn't just click on the designer and say, create a context for me. I had to do this by hand. But again, eventually the tool will probably catch up. Any questions there? Yeah, no. The other file in that particular project was this thing called a data source. Now, my data source doesn't inherit from anything. This is just a helper class that I have to actually communicate through my context class and grab my data. So here I have things like select, so I'm doing the link query against my table stores using the data context that I just created. So this is just a very simple helper class, if you will. Okay, so let's go back to our CodeBehind file. So that's what this is. So I have my entry, and I also have an instance of my helper class that I created. So once I have an instance to my helper class, I literally just call this method called addGuestBookEntry. Okay? And then after that, we're going to write to the trace again. If we take a look at this method, okay, here it is. I'm simply just taking the new item that I created and passing it into my context. Always providing the container, in this case, guestbook entry, so that I can actually add that table into that container that was created. Okay? So this is nothing fancy here. Now, at this point on the code, I have my blob store, my image store. I have a table entry store for me with my message name, the message text, the actual name of the guest. Okay? And actually, there's also some other stuff here because one of the things that guest entry class took is also the URI for both the URL and the thumb URL, which in this case, they're both set to the URI of the blob. Okay? So now here's the queue. Same thing. I'm going to create a reference to the guest thumb queue container. And I'm going to create a new message. In this case, I just need to call this new class, queue message class, and I'm going to provide it with the following information. The name of the blob, okay, the unique name of the blob that we created earlier. And I'm also going to provide the partition key and the row key. Okay, those are the two things that I'm providing. Well, actually, the three things. The name of the file, or the blob file, and then the partition key and the entry key, the row entry key. Now, once I have that, I'm going to set this guy to the queue by simply just saying, add this message to the queue. So what is that doing behind the scenes? Well, what's that doing is once I add this data, I also want to create a thumb version of that image. But I don't want my user to have to wait there for that to happen. I'm going to upload that process to my worker role and have my worker role do that work for me. Is that making any sense now? Okay. So I'm going to go ahead. We're going to go to the worker role. And I'm not going to step through this code here. But this code basically is just every I think every second or so, it's on a loop. And every second is going to go to that queue to see if there are any messages. And if there are messages, it's going to grab the message, because I already passed the name of the queue and the name of the container. It's going to go ahead, grab that blob, that image. It's going to take that image. It's going to create a thumb version of that image. And it's going to take that table entry that we created, and it's going to update the thumb URL for that to be the new image that the new thumb image that it created. Does that make any sense? Are you guys following that so far? Okay, so after that code gets executed, this is what we have. First, we created the blob, right? We uploaded the image. Second, we created a table entry with the name of the blob, with the name of the guest, the text of that the guest left, and the URL of the blob image, and also a URL of the thumb image. Then I created a new message saying, hey, this is new entry added in. My worker role went, picked up that message. That message again contained the name of the blob and also the partition key of that message that I created. It took that blob. It created a thumb version of that blob. It saved it on that same storage. And then it updated that table entry with the new thumbnail image. And that's it. Okay, so that's how my client was able to then get the thumb image, because the worker thread processed it from a queue and created that thumb image from there. Does that make any sense? Any questions on that? Okay. And again, it did it all using Link. There's something else here that I want to show you. There you go. Alright, so if you ever need to analyze that data, how do you do that? Well, we have a pretty nice tool here that is called the Azure Storage Explorer, which basically allows me to analyze what's in my storage account. So I can do both my local storage and also my actual cloud storage. In this case, we're going to analyze the local storage. As you can see here, it's telling me that I have three blob containers. Okay, one of them being this thing called guestbook. And as you can expect, there are two entries there. One, the image that I just uploaded, plus the thumbnail. It's telling me that I have one item in the queue, which I should. Actually, I removed it after I used it. So it's just telling me that I have one queue container called guest thumb. And also telling me that I have one guestbook entry. Okay? So from here, I can go ahead and reset this if I want to. Well, I'm going to run the query here so that you can see the entry. Guest name Danilo Diaz. Message loving that blink tag, just as I put it in. So I can use this to analyze what's going on in the cloud and what's also going on locally. From here, I can also delete or reset this. Am I missing? Oh, wait a minute. Where is this? Here you go. So I can come here and I can say, take that container, delete it. Yes, I do. So now, if I were to run my, I'm going to take that queue here. I'm going to delete it. Well, take this entry, I guess. Oh, no, let's leave it there. If I were to rerun this application now, I should be able to see the message with a broken link, right? Because I just removed that file, that block from the storage. So, what's the point here, right? Well, the point is that we showed you throughout the day how Link, I mean, we talked about this being a data access, event. It's really more about Link. right? So I showed you how you can use Ling to talk to different data sources. SQL, if you just want to use Ling to SQL. Using Ling to entities, you can talk to multiple sets of databases. By the way, here you go, right? Because I deleted that through the file explorer. We talked about Ling being able to talk to all data feeds. And I'll just show you now how you can take advantage of this cloud computing platform and how everything, even though it's available through RESTful APIs, it's also programmable using regular .NET code and using Ling. Okay? So that's hopefully the what you got out of the day. Any questions about either what I just talked about or what anything that we talked about through the event today?